Now, we have mentioned papias, this very early testimony to the fact that Matthew wrote first, and Matthew wrote in Hebrew or Aramaic, and that, as he says, other people interpreted him as best they could, probably meaning that those Greek speakers interpreted or translated Matthew's Hebrew as best they could. Now, papias is often discounted as a credible testimony on the basis of what Eusebius says about him. Eusebius says that papias is a man of little intelligence, even though Eusebius does say that papias records that Matthew wrote first. Now, how do we take Eusebius's account of papias's credibility? Well, we have to understand that Eusebius is a vehement anti-Chiliast. He's a vehement anti-premillennialist, and papias was a premillennialist. And it was not uncommon for Eusebius or Origen to disparage the Chiliasts. And so really we need to discount the pejorative terms that Eusebius uses and just take papias seriously. We should do this especially because, as Borkum has brought out, papias is reporting his testimony in a particularly scholarly way, the way that the scholars would report their sources. And papias is known in other sources to be an extremely literate and scholarly individual. He wrote 5 books, which were all well known in the early church, none of which unfortunately have survived. He was well thought of by Irenaeus, who was before Eusebius, and of course is one of the major theologians of the 2nd century. And so, we should take Papias's views seriously. Now, some people have said that Papias speaks about Matthew's gospel or Matthew's work as a logion. He uses the term logion. And therefore, they have surmised that he's not talking about the gospel of Matthew at all. He's talking about some notes of sayings of Jesus that Matthew wrote down. And they say, well, that's the normal use of the term ta logia. But Wenham brings out that B.B. Warfield and others have clearly written against that and proved that logion is the term for gospel that was used. This can be found in Warfield's article, The Oracles of God, which you can find online. It's a 55-page article, and it's very technical, so I haven't put it up for you on the website. But it is available. You'll be able to search for it and find it if you want to battle your way through it. It's not an easy article to read. But Wenham quotes Warfield's conclusion thus: it means not words barely, simple utterances, but distinctively oracular utterances, divinely authoritative communications, before which men stand in awe and to which they bow in humility. And this high meaning is not merely implicit, but is explicit in the term. It would seem clear again that there are no implications of brevity in the term. It means not short, pithy, pregnant sayings, but high, authoritative, sacred utterances. And it may be applied equally well to long as to short utterances. That's B.B. Warfield, the great biblical scholar. And so, even those attempts by people to say that papias meant by logia, probably this catalogue of Jesus' sayings, is not borne out by the scholarly work that has been done on the term. It does mean high authoritative and gospel-like work. We have seen that the early fathers are all in accord when it comes to Matthew writing first. We have seen that if we start from the premise that Mark wrote first, then we make Matthew out to be somebody, and Luke also, who changes the original material to suit his particular community, including, of course, putting in the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus never spoke, and making it seem as though Jesus did speak it. This would mean that Matthew is actually inventing history and then reporting it as though it was history. What this does to the theory of inspiration is anyone's guess. Rather, what we've been teaching here is that Matthew wrote first and didn't invent anything. Matthew is the first gospel. Mark is a supplement to Matthew's gospel from the testimony of Peter, and that Luke is following the order of Mark. Luke seems to know Matthew, but he's following the order of Mark, but he has an awful lot of his own material, possibly taken from some of the 70 who were sent out by Jesus, and therefore has very early material of his own to bring into his particular gospel account. Luke nowhere gives the indication that he's an unreliable witness. In fact, he seems to be an extremely reliable witness. And so to believe that Luke is changing Mark and material and just polishing it up and making it better goes against all that we know about Luke as a true representative. It also goes against what Luke himself says in his prologue, because Luke in his prologue is very careful to tell Theophilus that he's actually reporting carefully what he has seen and heard. Luke chapter 1 verses 1 through 4 says, quote, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word have handed them down to us, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you have been taught." Now, of course, you are to read Felix's chapter on the Lucan prologue, which is in the Jesus Crisis, which goes into this much more. But just from that, you can see that Luke here, if he's to be taken seriously, is not somebody who's a redactor. He's not somebody who's a changer and manipulator of the sources that he has been using. But he is a faithful reporter of this material. And therefore, Luke, again, is an independent witness following the order of Mark, following the sense of Mark, but having his own material to rely on. Now, what Wenham comes to then is basically what the early church has said. Matthew is an independent witness. Mark is an independent witness. Luke is an independent witness. But Mark knows Matthew and supplements him. Luke knows Mark and Matthew, but Luke is following Mark's account, but he has his own material to rely on, and the testimonies of others to rely on. Sometimes he's going to agree with Mark on the wording. Sometimes he's going to disagree. Luke has probably written sources or other sources that he's using, whereas Mark is using the verbal account of Peter, which accounts for the vividness and other stylistic idiosyncrasies or stylistic issues within Mark's account. And therefore, we believe that the original order, Matthew, Mark, Luke, is accounted for without any need for Q or Markan priority. Now, there is so much more to add to this, and all I can do is to recommend to you that you try, by hook or by crook, to purchase John Wenham's Redating Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and read the book for yourself. As I said, I've tried to read from Wenham as much as I can to give you an idea of the kind of arguments that he uses. And I would have definitely made this a required textbook for the course, but it's not available, and it seems to be quite expensive to procure. But keep going. See if you can find it, and maybe the Lord will bless you like he blessed me, and you can get it for $7 instead of $115. Now we've addressed the issue of the sequence of the gospel accounts, we need to add a little bit more spice, a little bit more detail. If the two document theorists are right, we need to be aware of what they are telling us. They are telling us that Matthew and Luke performed deeds which were not performed by any other writer in the ancient world, as far as the complexity and the difficulty of copying and editing huge scrolls, 30-foot scrolls, and changing the materials around. When you actually understand what went on in the scholarly circles of the day, this becomes very implausible. And so we're going to turn now to the subject of the difficulty of copying and of especially editing materials from scrolls in the ancient world. And again, Wenham helps us out a great deal here in his work, in this chapter, How Were the Gospels Written? And so I'm going to start reading for you from page 204 and insert some comments as we go down. First of all, Wenham quotes the eminent French authority on manuscripts, Dain, D-A-I-N, who says this, quote, "With very rare exceptions, one always sees the copyist in a quite characteristic attitude. He does not execute his copy on a desk or reading stand, nor a fortiori on a table, but he writes on his knees, usually but not always, with a board serving as a writing surface for him. It is astonishing that the professional copyist should not have used a table for their work. The truth is that antiquity did not know what we call a writing table. The table virtually serves only for eating, and it is always very low," because of course they recline on couches, remember. "It is only in the second part of the Middle Ages that one finds representations showing copyists writing on a desk, or even on a table. There is then a classical copyist position of reading a papyrus. The person is seated, his left leg bent," and you might try this yourself, "his right leg is vertical and his knee supports the little writing board on which he writes. With the right hand he traces the written marks, while with the left hand he holds the sheet of parchment." Now put yourself in that position. Get yourself on, something like one of those mechanics boards, you know, the movable boards that people use for going under their cars. Sit yourself on one of those, put your left leg behind you and your right leg in front of you, and have a tablet with a piece of paper on it, and of course you have to hold that tablet with a hand. Then you've only got one hand free to do the writing with. Now imagine that you're dealing with a huge scroll, and that this scroll is written in uncial, that is, capital letters, which are all joined together without any punctuation. And then can you see the almost Herculean task it would be to try and redact or edit materials in the way that these Q theorists are saying Matthew and Luke redacted Mark and Q? It becomes an almost impossible task. On page 205, Wenham, quoting from Bruce Metzger, an article saying, "When did scribes begin to use writing desks?" We find this note. "When a scribe was making relatively brief notes on a wax tablet or on a sheet of papyrus or parchment, he would usually stand and write while holding the material in his left hand. When a scribe had a more extensive task, such as the copying of a rather lengthy manuscript, he would sit occasionally on the ground, but more often on a stool or bench, supporting the scroll or codex on his knees. Wenham adds, he discounts the idea that the table in the scripturium at Qumran, which was solid and only 17.5 inches high, could have served as a writing desk. Nothing could give a more vivid idea of the awkwardness of redactional work than a study of plates 3-19 in Metzger's book, which show how cramped scribes were even when they began to have desks to work at. In the first century, tables and chairs such as we know them did not exist. Diners reclined, propped up on an elbow at the low tables, Jesus at the upper room, for example. To consult more than one scroll, an author would presumably have to have spread them out on such a table or on such a floor and either crawl around on hands and knees or else repeatedly crouch down and stand up again, looking at first one and then another. He could either make notes or commit them to memory before writing the matter up on a sheet of papyrus or vellum, or possibly sitting down and transferring it to his new scroll. Finding the place, unless he was prepared seriously to deface his scrolls, would be difficult. Handling a reed pen dipped in ink, or moistened to get ink from a dry ink cake, to write on a surface made of strips of papyrus pith was a skilled operation, which Paul seems usually to have left to an amanuensis. In a community where most had small, dark, crowded homes, finding a room suitable for the task and reasonably free from distractions would not be easy. Are we beginning to get the picture? Now, it might be easy for somebody writing in the 20th century to imagine how Matthew might have copied Mark, or Luke may have copied Mark and Q, from their vantage point in the 20th century. When you put it back into the first century and what they had to deal with, then it becomes more and more implausible to start to believe in redactional activity. And then on page 206, Wenham says this, in ideal conditions, it was not particularly difficult for a trained scribe simply to copy a scroll, though, as Dane points out, it required great concentration. Copying with some adaptation was also common in the ancient world, but it was the work of highly educated scholars. For one who was not a professional to take a lengthy manuscript with no chapter, verse, or even word divisions, and select, rearrange, and revise it, was a formidable task. It is highly unlikely that one gospel was produced as the result of an author working directly on the scroll of another, even less that he worked on two or three at once. And then he quotes Gerald Downing, his article Compositional Conventions and the Synoptic Problem, where Downing, looking at the methods adopted by scholars Livy, Plutarch, Hieronymus of Cardia, Lucian, and Josephus, says this, quote, we are in a position to tell with a considerable degree of certainty what compositional procedures for making use of existing writings would have been readily available in the first century. We can tell on the basis of many examples of practice and some indications of theory, even the most highly literate and sophisticated writers employ relatively simple approaches to their sources. Conflation was itself only rarely attempted, and then only simply effected. The long debate on the sources of the Synoptic Gospels seems to have been conducted without paying much or any attention to this issue of whether any indications of sensible compositional procedures in the first century are available. And then he quotes the scholar Pelling. Thus, quote, Livy read widely, but nevertheless followed a single source for a single section. Within these sections, he would occasionally add supplementary items from other sources, but he would not use a number of sources to weave together a coherent or independent account of his own. In other words, what we're expecting Matthew and Luke to do, Livy, one of the most scholarly historians and writers, did not do. And so I think we need a reality check here from those people who believe in a two-source theory. Then on page 207, Wenham says this, "It is unlikely that a gospel writer worked directly on the scroll or scrolls of his predecessors. It is more likely that he started by writing down the words and deeds of Jesus after the manner of his normal oral instruction, and that he then used the written word of the earlier evangelist to check and improve what he had written." So he's not examining stuff with the text of Mark or Matthew that he's constantly consulting. Rather, it appears that he has read through, say Luke has read through Mark, is following an outline that he has written down after checking Mark, and is occasionally looking over to check what he has composed against Mark. In other words, he's using Mark infrequently as a check. He's already got his outline that he's brought out from Mark. That would seem to be a much more plausible way of understanding, for example, Luke's use of Mark's account and Mark's use of Matthew's account. And so we have this issue, therefore, of how the Gospels were written, which must address this very difficult issue of editing and copying in the first century world. Finally, then, we need to look at the question of when the Gospels were written. Now, usually, it is stated that Mark is the earliest Gospel, and Mark is writing around about from 60 to 68 AD. That Matthew is using Mark, and therefore that Matthew is written after that date. Some, for example Blomberg, will allow that Matthew was possibly written before AD 70. AD 70 is a great cut-off date, of course, because that's when the Roman armies of Titus leveled Jerusalem. And after that, no more Pharisees, no more Sadducees, no more temple. And so the materials that would have been reported as being eyewitness materials, for example, paying the temple tax or the issue of the Sadducees and so on, would become less important after that date. The point is that if Matthew is written first, and if Matthew is written in Hebrew, and if Matthew betrays all of these signs of being written for a Jewish audience, then we've got to put him back to the early chapters of Acts. Now, the book of Acts, according to many scholars, F.F. Bruce, and Wenham, and Hemmer, C.J. Hemmer, was written approximately A.D. 62. That's when its cutoff is, in Acts 28, dated to about A.D. 62. That's way before A.D. 70. Now, of course, Acts is preceded by what? The Gospel of Luke. And so this puts the Gospel of Luke at around AD 60. Luke used Mark, which puts Mark prior to AD 60. Now, if we add the issue of Mark being a work that is based on Peter's oral testimony, then there is a probability that Mark, and there's very strong historical precedent for this, that Mark was written in Rome when Peter was in Rome, according to the ancient testimony, in the early to mid 40s AD. Now, Peter left Rome around about AD 45, according to many ancient testimonies, and therefore would not have been in Rome at the time that Paul wrote Romans in AD 57. But it would mean that when Peter left Rome, there would have been every reason to think that the Roman Church would have wanted an account of Peter's teaching. And therefore, Mark, who, according to early tradition, is a companion of Peter in that early time, would have written down Peter's account of the gospel. This would have meant that Mark would have been written in the early 40s AD. Now, we're not saying it definitely was written at that time. We're just saying that there is strong reason to believe that Mark was written that early, about AD 44 or 45. Now, if Mark is written in AD 45 and Matthew predates Mark, this puts Matthew at about AD 40, which is around about the traditional date. In fact, Eusebius gives a date of around about 41, AD 41, for the composition of Matthew. And remember, as we've said, quoting J.B. Lightfoot, Eusebius has not been found to be wrong when it comes to those kinds of details. So, Wenham concludes, and let's turn to him. I'm going to turn now to page 243, where he sums up his work. He says this: "The argument of the book, which has eight major stages, has been cumulative. 1. Verbal synoptic likenesses and differences are best explained by independent use of the primitive form of oral instruction. Either Matthew, of course, with the help of the other evangelists, being an eyewitness, deciding what is going to be written down as an authoritative early account of Jesus. Mark being Peter's account. Luke being based on accounts possibly of, well, as he says, eyewitnesses, probably some of the 70, as well as based on Mark's account, or at least following Mark's chronological order. So that's the first thing. Independent accounts, but based on primitive oral transmission, which fits in with what we know of the culture. Second, genre and order are best explained by a literary relationship. So there is some literary relationship between, of course, Luke and Mark. Luke following Mark's order, Mark being aware of Matthew, but supplementing it, not replacing it. 3. In particular, Luke knew Mark's gospel. 4. Dates should be reckoned by working back from the book of Acts, the natural date of which is AD 62. 5. Luke's gospel was apparently well known in the mid-50s. Now, we haven't had time to deal with that, but Wenham does in his book. 6. According to tradition, Mark's gospel gives Peter's teaching in Rome. And as Peter was in Rome, according to the same tradition, in the early to mid-40s AD, that is where we should date Mark's gospel. So, 7. Peter's first visit to Rome was probably 42 to 44, and Mark's gospel was probably written about AD 45. And then the eighth stage of Wenham's cumulative argument is, the universal tradition of the early church puts Matthew first, which means a date around AD 40. And there is much more material that we've not been able to bring out here. One of them I might include here is a quotation from the scholar Burks about the early reporting of Matthew for apologetic reasons of the disappearance of the body and the counter-evidence concocted by the chief priests. Burks says this, quote, "The fact that this gospel alone records the watch and the report spread among the Jews implies naturally that it was written earlier than the others, when the fact of the watch being set was most likely to confirm the evidence of the resurrection from being familiarly known." and when the counter-explanation, being also well known, would stand most in need of refutation by a simple, unadorned statement of the events themselves. End quote. And so, we believe that Wenham has brought forward strong arguments to discount the two-source hypothesis, to destroy the whole Q theory and Mark and priority, to put the original order of Matthew, Mark, and Luke back where it belongs, as Matthew writing first, then Mark, and then Luke, of going back from the Acts of the Apostles, dated by many authorities at AD 62, therefore putting Luke into the 50s, putting Mark at least into the early 50s and probably into the 40s, and putting Matthew before that. Now, Blomberg, Carson, Hagner, and many of the other scholars, commentaries that you'll read, Bach and so on Luke, will not have these dates. They will have later dates because they buy into the two-document hypothesis. If you buy into the two-document hypothesis, you're going to put Matthew later. You're going to discount the testimony of the Acts of the Apostles and the date that it was written. If you throw off the two-document hypothesis and the need for Q and so on, then you can go back to the early testimony. You can go back and say, hey, Matthew does appear to be very early, written for a Jewish audience. Why would he be writing to a Jewish audience after AD 70 and the dispersal? Surely it makes sense that Matthew is a very early account. And therefore, Matthew is to be put first in 40 to 41 AD. Mark, as Peter's account, is to be put after that, either around 45 AD, which is where Wenham places him, or in the early 50s AD. Then Luke is to be put in the mid to late 50s AD. And then, of course, the book of Acts is written around about 62 to, say, 65 AD. It finishes around about 62 AD, and therefore, it knows nothing of the destruction of the temple, for example. And therefore, all of the Synoptic Gospels were written prior to AD 70. Now, the major support for those that believe that Matthew was written after AD 70, apart from their disbelief that he could have known about the destruction of the temple and so on, is that twice, for example, in his reporting of the field of Akeldama, Matthew talks about something that is known to this day. So the critics say, well, he couldn't have written to this day unless he was writing a generation or so after the events. But Wenham quotes the scholar Townsend as saying, well, this is just begging the whole question. It is perfectly possible, particularly when you have changes that are happening in and around Jerusalem with the birth of the church and the growing resentment against the Roman authorities, it is perfectly possible that in that maelstrom, just a couple of years would see great changes. And therefore, it is not at all unlikely that Matthew writing, say, 10 years after the events that he records, would have said to this day. You don't have to posit that Matthew was writing in AD 80. He could very well be writing in AD 40 and using that term in a perfectly understandable way. So that is no argument at all against Matthew's date. The last thing that I want to deal with here in this section on the synoptic problem is something that Darrell Bock says in his review of the Jesus Crisis in the April to June 2000 issue of Bibliotheca Sacra. There's a long review of the Jesus Crisis by Bock, and in there he has this paragraph, which I want to read to you. How to explain such textual details remains an issue regardless of whether one argues for a literary relationship between the Gospels or for their independence. Yet the book, that is the Jesus Crisis, speaks as if literary independence answers everything, when it does not adequately answer or even address many complex textual and historical problems. Consider, for example, the order of the temptations. Is Matthew's or Luke's order chronologically correct? If one of them has given a different order, is that not a redaction of historical detail? In other words, isn't one of them editing one of the accounts? To continue here, what exactly did the voice from heaven say to Jesus at his baptism? This is my son, Matthew 3:17, or you are my son, Mark 1:11, Luke 3:22. What precisely happened to the cursed fig tree in the timing of its demise? Was it at once, Matthew 21:19, or in the next morning, Mark 11:20? What was the exact time of the death of Jairus' daughter? Before the conversation, Matthew 9:18, or during the conversation, Luke 8:49? What exactly did the high priest say to Jesus at his trial? I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God, Matthew 26:63, a statement, or are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, Mark 14:61, a question? And how exactly did Jesus reply? These are details in the text the Holy Spirit has given us. Can we defend the standard of precision the Jesus Christ argues for in all of these cases, a standard that the book requires as orthodoxy? Why are such hard examples not addressed? End quote. So what we need to do, I think, before closing this little issue, is to try to at least address some of these difficult problems that Bock sets for us, because he's not wrong at all in pointing out that these discrepancies or these issues, these problems, have to be addressed. All I would say here is that it is most important to understand that whichever view you take, this does not prove the necessity for Mark and priority. These issues remain, whether you have Mark and priority or Matthew and priority. In other words, these issues are aside from the synoptic problem. They are textual issues that have to be addressed in whatever theory you use. And so we need to spend a little bit of time addressing that issue, which we're going to do in the next lecture, and then we'll get on to dealing with the Gospels themselves.